Peace Health Peace Harbor Medical Center presents Doc Talk, an informative health series educating our community on the services provided at Peace Health. We will begin with our host, George Henry, after these messages.
You're not feeling well? You twist your ankle? Or you have that pain in your shoulder that just doesn't go away? There is an alternative to the emergency room. It's a Peace Health walk-in clinic. There's no appointment necessary, and you may have to wait, but you could see someone today. It's open 6 days a week in the 380 building just across from Peace Health Peace Harbor Medical Center. The Peace Health Walk-In Clinic, your local health partners.
At some point in her life, one out of every eight women will get breast cancer. One out of eight. Most women can beat it, but only with early detection. Don't let breast cancer stop you. Mammograms save lives.
Better total care. Peace Harbor Imaging now has digital mammograms. Get one.
Joining me now for this edition of Doc Talk is the Peace Health Medical Group Medical Director, Ron Shear. Dr. Ron Shear, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing today?
Good. Good to see you again. And let's start off. You've been at Peace Health, Peace Harbor, what, 23 years now?
23 years.
And give me a little bit of background. Where did you start off from as far as university goes?
Well, I grew up in Eastern Oregon and went to Corvallis at Oregon State and then went to medical school in Portland at University of Oregon Health Sciences Center. And then my residency in Bakersfield, California. And I got stuck down there for about 15 years and then eventually made my way back to Oregon and came here. Been here since then.
What was it that allured you about the medical field in the first place?
Oh, that's a tough question. Well, I wasn't sure what I was going to do. I was just taking science classes, and then my dad had a heart attack. And when I grew up in East Oregon, there really wasn't much of a medical presence there. I mean, we had to drive an hour and a half just to go to the dentist. Mm-hmm. So I just hadn't really been exposed to it that much.
So you just saw the opportunity to...
Well, it turned out I was taking all the right classes, and so I was lucky enough to be able to go and take the medical school admission test and got admitted.
Wow. So, I mean, did you have any concerns when you first decided to do it as to how well you would do in the field?
I guess not. I probably should have, maybe. But
right. One of those things, you don't know what you don't know. So
no, I was in fisheries and wildlife for a while. I was in chemistry and chemical engineering, physics. Actually student taught for a quarter. I just hadn't really found anything else that hit me like that.
Right. But all things were of the scientific nature that you were kind of interested in to begin with anyway.
Yeah, which seemed to work out well with the admitting process for medical school.
So you've seen, obviously, you've seen a lot of changes in the medical field over time and a lot of attitude changes towards certain things. And that's kind of why you're here today. You want to talk about the opioid crisis and how that has kind of become the top of mind awareness thing now. When did you notice there was problems in that area as far as the opioid prescriptions, addictions, and then, you know, the crisis nature of it?
Well, it's kind of like a pendulum that swings one way and then swings the other way, sometimes overcorrects a little bit. When I was practicing in California, we very rarely used narcotics for things like chronic back pain or osteoarthritis of the knees and stuff like that. And up here, we weren't using a lot until about 2001 is when things kind of first started changing and it started swinging the other way.
Was the main reason the complaints of the patients about pain, or was it just, did it just seem to be the right thing to do at the time?
Well, it was a combination of things. There was when we check vital signs, usually your pulse and your respiratory rate and your temperature and your blood pressure, and then they added pain as the fifth vital sign. Usually if you're checking a measurement like that, you plan to do something with it. And so that kind of forced you a little bit more to do something about pain. The expectation was you're going to treat it. And at that time, the head of the medical board actually came down to Florence and says, we don't want you to feel like you're walking on a tightrope, but if you're treating it too much, we don't want that. But if you're not treating it enough, we don't want that either. And they'd actually taken, I think it was from Medford, an anesthesiology provider, to the medical board for not treating pain enough. So that got people's attention. And we were told at the time that, you know, you really shouldn't be worried about how much you're given or the likelihood that people might get addicted to the medication. And so it kind of went forward.
And that's the pendulum thing, overcorrecting in the other direction there.
Yeah.
Has there been any studies done versus the psychological, not creation of pain, but the psychological evidence of pain versus the physical evidence of pain?
Yeah, I kind of wish Wayne Loudon came with me today. He has that chronic pain class that he gives, and that's one of the things he talks about. It's one of those strange areas. If I'm treating you for your blood pressure, I can measure your blood pressure, and we can treat you and see how it responds. But with pain, it's purely subjective. So I can only tell what pain you're having by what you tell me you have. Some people can have a lot of pain and have absolutely no physical findings that I can see. And other people have a lot of physical findings but don't seem to have much pain. So it makes it tough.
So when they first started prescribing it, I guess obviously there's the healing nature of the body, you know, begins to heal over time anyway. Was it just mainly for the beginning of the healing process? Was that the idea? Was that the psychology behind it, just to get them on the healing path?
I think so. Narcotics is what we're talking about with mostly chronic pain is where it's coming to. And for acute pain, that's still the standard. So we actually get measured on a long bone fracture. How quickly did we give them something to relieve their pain? And often it's given in the ambulance on the way into the ER. We try to get it that quickly. For chronic pain, we have it in months and years, everything kind of changes a little bit.
Well, let's step back a second. Let's define exactly what an opioid is. There's, you know, in my mind, I think of things like Oxycontin and stuff like that. I mean, is that kind of in that vein?
Well, you know, there's many types of pain relievers, a lot of them over the counter. So acetaminophen or Tylenol, naproxen, ibuprofen, aspirin, going way back, or those are all over the counter. You can buy those without a prescription. When you get into prescription medications, there are also anti-inflammatories. And then you go into – and other things we use for pain like gabapentin, antidepressants, and stuff like that. But when you go into narcotics, there's opiates, which are derived from the opium poppy. And there's opioids, which are opiates plus the synthetically derived ones like fentanyl. So common narcotics that we might see would be hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, heroin. And those are all derived from the opium poppy. And then there's synthetic ones like fentanyl, which you hear a lot, that's a really potent narcotic. They can be classified also by strength. So we use what's called a morphine equivalent dose. So we take a narcotic and compare it in strength to morphine. For instance, hydrocodone is 10 milligrams of hydrocodone is equal to 10 milligrams of morphine. 10 milligrams of oxycodone is equivalent to 15 milligrams of morphine. So oxycodone is actually stronger than morphine. And we tend not to think of it that way because it's a common prescribed pill. And then when you get into things like fentanyl, it's a lot much stronger.
When did fentanyl become, when did they develop that and start putting that into?
Ooh, tough question. I'm not sure I know that. Mm-hmm. It's certainly been around for a number of years in various forms. We use intravenous forms sometimes when we're using colonoscopies, or we used to. We kind of switched out of that. And then there's sustained-release patches for fentanyl are probably the most common way it's prescribed now. The deaths that we see with opioids are usually associated with strong opioids like fentanyl or combining narcotics with benzodiazepines like Valium or Xanax. And I think a lot of the fentanyl overdose are not necessarily prescription, but manufactured and coming from other countries illegally.
And so things like that, especially in combination, they slow the heart, they stop the heart.
Is that stop the respirations.
And then
from there, going to the heart.
All right. And so I remember hearing the term, and this probably has nothing to do with it, but I'll ask so I can be clear in my head. Back in the day, they had the diet pills that had fen-phen in it. Is that part of the fentanyl family, or is that something?
No, that's completely different. Those are actually stimulants.
Okay.
So they're more like methamphetamine.
Like a speed, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So with the opioid crisis hitting, well, actually you said the more of the prescription writing started in around 2000, 2001, somewhere yeah. around there. When did they recognize that it was a critical phase?
Well, for us, it came what about probably 3 or 4 years ago, where we had a lot of patients that now had escalated up their dosages. Some of them had moved from other states, maybe, but at least from pain specialist on high doses. It seemed to be used a lot more, and the doses are being a lot higher. And medical marijuana was coming out at the same time. And it was also at the same time we had a provider crisis for the a provider shortage in town, too. So it all kind of hit us all at once.
All at the same time. We're talking with Dr. Ronald Scheer. He's the Peace Health Medical Group Medical Director at Peace Health Peace Harbor Medical Center. And we're talking opioids and the opioid crisis. We'll be back in just a moment.
You're not feeling well? You twist your ankle? Or you have that pain in your shoulder that just doesn't go away? There is an alternative to the emergency room. It's a Peace Health walk-in clinic. There's no appointment necessary, and you may have to wait, but you could see someone today. It's open 6 days a week in the 380 building just across from Peace Health Peace Harbor Medical Center. The Peace Health Walk-In Clinic, your local health partners.
At some point in her life, one out of every eight women will get breast cancer. One out of eight. Most women can beat it, but only with early detection. Don't let breast cancer stop you. Mammograms save lives.
Better Total Care. Peace Harbor Imaging now has digital mammograms. Get one.
We're talking with Dr. Ronald Scheer on this edition of Doc Talk. He's the Peace Health Medical Group Medical Director. He's been there 23 years now, and obviously, Dr. Scheer, you've seen a lot of changes. We were talking before the break about the idea of when the crisis began. When you recognize that something had to be done, what were some of the steps that were taken in order to kind of correct what was going on?
Well, it hit us pretty fast and hard, and I'd had conversations with the medical director from the state of Washington, the medical director from the state of Oregon's medical boards. And we were also working at that time closely with the Washington Collaborative, who was a group of physicians of broad different specialties that were formatting how we should be attacking this. And so we went with the Washington Collaborative's recommendations. In fact, we actually used them. We could present patients to them for their opinions, and they would give those back, and we could utilize their services that way. And so we tried to adjust everyone to a morphine equivalent dose of less than 120 at that time. Currently, we're at 90. I suspect we'll go to 50 eventually because that's where the danger seems to start creeping up. We also cut down the use of muscle relaxers, stopped the use of Soma particularly because that one's a notorious one for causing problems, and tried to avoid the concomitant use of benzodiazepines like Xanax and Valium when we're prescribing narcotics. We also, with the Western Collaborative and with Peace Health, decided not to prescribe controlled substances to anyone that's taking marijuana or alcohol. That was a tough one. Both those are legal. Mm-hmm. And many people say, you know, I'd like to have one beer at night. But with the interaction that it has with the medications, we put that as a stop on the prescriptions if that occurred.
Has there ever been a study done that shows maybe the correlation also between like nicotine and tobacco and that too? Because obviously there are some drug aspects to tobacco.
Not so much as the danger of the medications with it, like there would be with alcohol, say. Yeah. But one of the things that I've really seen, a lot of people that have really bad back pain are also smokers. And I remember one study I was reading where if you have a person at work that's injured and they have a back injury, there's about a 85% chance they're going to get back to work fairly quickly and do well. But if they smoke, that drops down to about 60. And so there's a close association with back pain and smoking and probably healing in general. Many plastic surgeons, if they're doing a plastic surgery on your face for a facelift or something, they don't want you smoking because you're not going to heal as well.
Wow, I didn't realize that that was one of the problems with smoking. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So if I see someone with chronic back pain and they smoke, that's one of the first things we'll talk about.
Yeah.
And it's difficult to quit.
That's definitely. Well, and I imagine it's difficult with some of the other issues with opioids. I noticed you mentioned like the combination of Xanax and what was the other drug?
Valium.
Valium. Was that something that happened in the 2002? Was there. Because is it more than just one drug that's being prescribed at a time? Is that what part of the problem was?
Yeah. And so you would see people that are on a narcotic at a high dose. They're taking Valium with it, maybe a muscle relaxer on a daily basis. They're taking a sleeping pill to get to sleep at night, which is usually those are related to benzodiazepines. And then maybe they're on a stimulant for attention deficit disorder to kind of make them so they're not so groggy.
Wow.
Yeah.
To me, I mean, I'm not a medical professional, but that doesn't really make sense.
No, it doesn't.
You know, because you have all these interactions. I mean, I lost my mother 2 years ago to dementia, but she was kind of okay. Then they put her in a home and they changed her medications. They were giving her 4 or 5 medications, and she just plummeted. I mean, within a few months, you know, from being fairly okay, a little bit of hey, where am I? Who am I? To where it was like flinging stuff and not knowing where
and
she was.
A lot of these medications we're talking about are a lot more dangerous the older you get. Mm. And so if you get someone that's got some balance problems, maybe some memory problems, and you put them on a sedating medication, especially one that has a long half-life or something like Soma, you can really get problems.
So what is Soma derived from? Is that a synthetic?
I don't know.
Okay.
Soma's an early muscle relaxer. It just seems to have a high abuse potential, and especially when you're using it with other medications. It maybe potentiates the effects of other medications when people are using it for recreational purposes.
So the crisis, you know, you mentioned like foreign brought in narcotics and stuff like that and medications. Is there a big problem with things coming across our borders and stuff like that people can get a lot easier? Maybe they're not the traditional, you know, opioids or opiates.
I don't think.
In other words, where's all the people that are abusing? Where's it all coming from?
Well, as I understand it, I think a lot of synthetic fentanyl is coming from China and places like that. I'm not sure about that. I'm not saying just what you might read also. And with the opioids crisis, there's really two parts. There's people that are taking prescription medications, and then people are taking illicit substances like heroin, fentanyl, things like that. And I think when I've read that some of the heroin now is getting cut with the fentanyl, which makes it stronger, you know, more potent. And if you're not used to that and you're used to taking the usual amount and you take extra, now you're in trouble.
So is the way to help someone get off of it just simply by decreasing over time, like in small amounts, decreasing it, or is there something else that goes along with that?
Well, a lot of people we've managed by slowly decreasing their narcotic dose down over time, and that's worked well. There's some medications like Soma we just stop. Sleeping medications are particularly hard to get people off of because they don't sleep and they don't appreciate that too much. And then some medications like the benzodiazepines, it's a real slow taper. There's a lot of literature on this from England. There's a webpage called the UK Benzo Page, where Mary Kay Ashton is a person that does that and talks about after you're off benzos, it may take you a year or two before your brain really gets back to normal, maybe longer.
Is there a certain personality type that seems to be affected more? Like I know like with there's some genetic things with some people that, you know, you take a drink and you become a totally different person. Is there some genetic or some personality traits in some people that make them more addictive than others?
Possibly some. When we are thinking about starting or maintaining a person on opiates, one of the things we look at is an opiate risk tool, and it looks at your past history of substance abuse, your past history of alcohol usage. I think smoking might be on there as well. So there's some things like that can predict, but it's pretty individual, and it's You know, it doesn't seem to separate by income or classes or races or anything else. Anyone could be a potential person.
But basically, you're using a questionnaire or something similar to look at possibly addictive behavior in the past.
Yeah, to give us some idea of what the risk might be. It's not perfect, though.
It never.
Never is.
Never, never is. We're talking with Dr. Rama Shear, Peace Health Medical Group Medical Director at Peace Health Peace Harbor Medical Center. And we'll come back and see what specifically is happening at Peace Health as far as the opioid crisis right after this.
You're not feeling well. You twist your ankle or you have that pain in your shoulder that just doesn't go away. There is an alternative to the emergency room. It's a Peace Health walk-in clinic. There's no appointment necessary, and you may have to wait, but you could see someone today. It's open 6 days a week in the 380 building just across from Peace Health Peace Harbor Medical Center. The Peace Health Walk-In Clinic, your local health partners.
At some point in her life, one out of every eight women will get breast cancer. One out of eight. Most women can beat it. But only with early detection. Don't let breast cancer stop you. Mammograms save lives.
Better Total Care. Peace Harbor Imaging now has digital mammograms. Get one.
On this edition of Doc Talk, we're talking with Dr. Ronald Shear. He's the Peace Health Medical Group Medical Director at Peace Health Peace Harbor Medical Center. And let's talk specifically about what things have changed at Peace Health Peace Harbor Medical Center.
Well, some things we're doing currently is we're certainly following national guidelines about where we should be at with these medications. But sometimes it's really difficult to get people down to where they should be. Some people, if they're unable to be weaned down to what level is appropriate, we'll refer them to a pain specialist. They're hard to come by. There's the closest would be Eugene. We do have a Suboxone prescribing provider who will help with that part of it. Suboxone's narcotic, but it's a little bit different. It's usually combined with naloxone. So when you take it, it tightly binds to receptors. And if you take another narcotic, you don't get the effect from it as much. So it kind of blocks it. It gives them some relief, but also blocks it from further narcotic use effects. Our anesthesia providers are using a lot of different measures to avoid using narcotics. We're using long-acting liposomal marcaine, which can numb you up for like 3 days, which after 3 days, a lot of your pain is now starting to be relieved. We've had some really good results with that. They also use intravenous Tylenol and some gabapentin and other stuff with it. But I remember one patient that really struck me. They had a hemorrhoidal surgery. And usually you get a call in 2 days, I'm out of pain meds and it's really painful. Do you have any more? Or I've been taking my pain meds and I'm really constipated and that's not a good thing with this operation. Mm-hmm. And the call came in and says, is it okay if I grab a halibut fishing? So pretty successful in that regard.
So the numbing aspect, is that a local then?
It's a local, but they had tried it in other parts of Peace Health and it wasn't too effective. But our anesthesia group had experience with it down, I think, at Davis. And it's pretty operator dependent how you inject it. So regular marcaine, you can inject and it spreads out. This, a liposomal marcaine, when you inject it, it stays just where it is. So it can take 4 or 5 times as long to inject an area to make sure you're covered. So instead of just like a 1 or 2 minute thing, it may take 8, 9, 10 minutes sometimes.
Okay. So now in surgeries and stuff like that, kind of the whole thing has changed on how, like you mentioned, like for post-surgery, there's things that fit people can do. You've introduced yoga, acupuncture.
Yeah.
I know you're working with one of the acupuncturists here in town, or you were. Is it still happening?
Yes, Peace Health supporting that.
Yeah. And so how has that changed? How is the attitude toward more of the,
holistic
Eastern
approach.
Medicine, holistic approach? Yeah.
Well, it doesn't work for everybody, but for those that it does, it can be pretty remarkable. I think it just gives another option. A person can kind of sort through a little bit more and figure out what may be the best course for them over time. One of the other things we've done that I've really been pleased with is in colonoscopies, we used to use fentanyl and Versed, which versus a benzodiazepine. So we're using the two medications that are kind of risky, and colonoscopies are usually in people as they're getting older. And having had one myself, you're pretty intoxicated for a long period of time afterwards, and you don't realize how much you really are. And I'm surprised we haven't had more falls and hip fractures and things like that in our population. We've changed to using propofol. It's a fast-acting medication, and you shut it off, and it's gone about 20 minutes. So it gets rid of the long-term effects. We don't have as much time in the recovery room, which could be a couple hours sometimes, so there's less nursing time devoted to them. It's just been a better procedure all the way around.
What do you see coming down the pipe as far as the future of maybe either new medications that don't have the lasting effects of, say, an opioid or an opiate versus, the more holistic approach? What do you see coming down the road?
Well, I think there'll be more of a thought process about other things we can do when the pain is not rapidly being relieved over time. And we are talking with a procedural pain specialist, see if we can get some of that in town. There are some things, especially nerve pain, that are very difficult to treat with narcotics. But sometimes gabapentin, which is a seizure disorder, a seizure medication, can be useful in taking care of that. Sometimes people can't tolerate the gabapentin. It is possible to block those nerves and block the pain. And that could be a long-term solution for some people. So that's another modality we're trying to bring into town.
What about something like fibromyalgia? Is that, because that's more of a chronic, is it low-grade pain usually in most people, or is it something that's...
I don't have fibromyalgia, so I can only, from what I've heard from patients, but as I understand it, like if you went out and exercised really heavy, the next day you'd feel sore. Mm-hmm. They feel that way every day.
Okay.
And there are some medications that are seem to be effective for it. Ironically, the pain medications, the opiates, tend to make it worse over time. And one of the best things you can do for it is a regular exercise program that's low grade and just slowly increasing. And when it gets to a point that it seems to be helping, maybe holding at that level, not trying to overdo it. It takes time to do that, though. And usually if we get a fibromyalgia patient and they're already on an opiate, when you decrease the opiate, sometimes it increases your pain. So if you put someone that maybe didn't have any pain at all and you put them on opiates and then started tapering it off, they'd be uncomfortable.
So where can people find out more if, for example, someone's suffering from pain or someone wants to know more about this? Is there a way they can contact the hospital, or is there anybody that can talk to them? Or?
Well, certainly their primary care physician is a good place to start. I think most primary care physicians are aware of what's going on nationally and in our community. There's many sources online. It seems like you can't hardly go anywhere without seeing something like this popping up. Mm-hmm. And some of those are better than others. If I was going online, things like Mayo Clinic's website, Peace Health's website.
So places that have a trustworthy component to them.
Yeah, they're a little bit reputable.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of pain specialists that have information on it, and they probably have some on their websites as well, over in Eugene, I think.
An end in sight for the crisis? Do you see one?
Well, I think the pendulum swings, and what it'll do in the future, I don't know. I do think that we're doing better care now than we used to. We used to do things like when a person came in with a migraine, they would get an injection of Demerol and Phenergan. We haven't done that in probably at least 5 years, so we don't give any injectable medications in the office or in the ER. And people seem to be doing just as well.
Obviously, educating the patient is an important part.
Yeah, and that your pain is not going to go away right now. There's sometimes a thought that I need it done and I need it right now. And that can lead to unfortunate complications over term.
Dr. Ronald Shearer is the Peace Health Medical Group Medical Director, and we're talking opioids. I thank you so much. Some good information there. I hope that if people have issues, they can talk to the primary care physician and go from there.
That sounds good. I think the other thing, if it's not getting handled, asking for a referral to a pain specialist. Sometimes we will send clear up to Portland. There's a fibromyalgia clinic in Portland that's going to be useful. So there's a lot of different modalities that are available. And so if one is not working for you, you just got to kind of be searching out the one that does work for you.
Dr. Ronald Shearer, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
You have been listening to Doc Talk, presented by Peace Health Peace Harbor Medical Center. For more information on the program and services provided, visit peacehealth.org.